All right, good morning, everybody, and welcome to Kabbalah and Coffee, live from Chabad in town of the In-Town Jewish Academy in Atlanta. It's good to see everybody this morning. Yay. Is the sound coming up? I'm talking. Can you hear me? We have to test it because I tried it a few days ago and it didn't work. The audio didn't work. Oh, it's not loading up yet? Oh, look at that. We're live. Okay. That's weird if I hear it now. It's done too much delay. Okay, so today our topic is unexpected blessings. So one thing that Kabbalah teaches is that blessings sometimes come from the most unexpected of places. You know, you would think a blessing comes in a straightforward fashion, the way we would expect a blessing to come from, but oftentimes it's not the case at all. And I think in our own lives, we all can relate to the fact that sometimes we've had an experience, met a person, you know, had a certain situation happen that we thought was the opposite of a blessing, and it turns out to be a tremendous blessing in our lives. Like, we weren't expecting to meet this person, and they suddenly, you know, we suddenly encountered them, met them, or they fell into our lives, or we fell into their lives. The next thing you know, it's a tremendous blessing for us. Or something happens that, you know, circumstance or situation happens that would otherwise be, you know, a little bit, maybe a painful experience or an unpleasant experience, and we think that we would define it as negative. It turns out that it's a blessing. So this is a theme that not only is present in our lives, but is also present in Jewish teachings. So we have it in Torah. We have it in Torah scripture. We have this concept of unexpected blessings. We have it in stories of the Talmud, incredible stories of blessings that come out of nowhere, totally unexpected. And of course, we have this in Kabbalah, which this is a Kabbalah class, a Kabbalah and Coffee. This is going to be a main feature and a main focus. We have this concept in Kabbalah where the greatest blessings come from the most unexpected of places. So let's begin this journey of unexpected blessings. I have a handout here that has several texts. Does everybody have a copy of this handout? Let's pass this around. How many more do we need?
One more.
One more? Okay. Here, pass these. Wait, just pass them to Judy and then she'll take care of it. Okay. And just in case, we need these as well. I would just put it down right next to you and that's, you know, yeah, that's perfect. Okay. All right, so let's begin. There's a concept that was taught by the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, that we have to live with the times. So this great Chassidic master once told his disciples, his students, you have to live with the times. And they were very confused because what is the rabbi exactly advocating to live with the times? His brother explained that he doesn't mean to, you know, follow, you know, what was then cutting edge Russian culture, but rather what he means is live with the Torah portion of the week. So it's interesting that when we talk about unexpected blessings, it perfectly connects with today's section of the Torah that we study. So just to explain, every week is associated with one of the 52 portions, or 53 portions of the Torah. So there are various Torah portions. Each is associated with a week. And within that week's Torah portion, there are seven readings. So on Shabbat, so the Torah is read and divided into seven distinct readings. So many have the custom to study one of those readings each day of the preceding week before the Sabbath. So we have Sunday, you would study the first reading, Monday the second, Tuesday the third, Wednesday the fourth, Thursday the fifth, Friday the sixth. And then on Shabbat, you study the seventh of the seven readings and you read the whole thing in services on Shabbat. So today we begin the upcoming Torah portion, which is called Balak. And in Balak, we read about a king whose name was Balak, and he is very concerned about the Jewish people and about their approach toward the land of Israel. And Balak wants to stop the Jews in their tracks. By the way, the Torah describes it classic fear-mongering to his people. He says to his people, there's this nation, and they're approaching, and they consume everything around them, and they're very dangerous, and we have to stop them. So it's classic, you know, this has been used by by people to kind of rile up the masses against, you know, groups. This is certainly Jews and others as well. For the ages, this is a historical, something that's been repeated often throughout history. But anyway, he ends up doing something fascinating, which is, famously, he hires a prophet that was basically a mercenary prophet, a prophet for hire. This prophet, right, he was not a non-profit prophet, he was a for-profit prophet. His name was Bilam, in the English, I'm not sure how he got this, this a little bit of a change and adjustment. In the English, he's called Balaam, although in Hebrew, again, he's Bilam, but in English, we know him as Balaam. Either way, he was a bad dude. He was a prophet, and he was tremendously connected with God. He had a connection, and yet he used his powers for evil. He used his powers to try to curse others and bring down their downfall, and bring them down, as opposed to using his gifts for the good, and that itself is a lesson. But one thing in this famous story comes clear. Good morning. And that is that every time this guy tries to curse the Jewish people, every time he opens his mouth, the curses are transformed into blessings. In fact, and here's something fascinating, some of the greatest blessings in all of Scripture about the Jewish people are not recited by Moses. They're not recited by, by Samuel or by Isaiah or by Ezekiel. Some of the greatest prophecies and praises of the Jewish people are cited by this enemy of the Jews, Balaam. It's incredible. It's almost like the message is that God is saying, I'm going to take the greatest antagonist, greatest enemy, and flip it for the good. It's not almost, that's exactly what's actually happening, where the blessing is coming from the most unexpected of places. It's interesting because our sages point out that Moses ends up being the one that chastises the people on several occasions. He tells them, like, you're not doing this, you need to be doing that, get your act together, or else. Like, he's the chastiser of the Moses. He's chastising the Jewish people, and Balaam, the enemy, so Moses, the leader, is chastising. Balaam, the enemy, is blessing the people. So it's kind of like you would expect Moses to be the blesser and Balaam to be the chastiser, and yet we find that there is this this crossing over, if you will, and basically our sages point out that if Moses blessed, no one would take it seriously. Because of course Moses is blessing the people, what else is he going to do? And if Balaam chastised, then no one would take that seriously. But when Moses chastises, then you take it to heart. If Moses is chastising, all right, let me listen. I know Moses loves me. If he's telling me something critical, I'm listening. And if Balaam praises, then I'm also going to take it seriously. So that's kind of the way it falls. I have on this handout, on the sheet. Yeah, that's a great idea. We should totally do that. Thank you. Here. You have? Perfect. Okay, we'll just leave that as an extra one. Okay, so I have here in the handout the three instances where Balaam attempts to curse the Jewish people, and again, they end up in all three cases as blessings. There's actually a fourth time in this Torah portion that Balaam that he blesses the people, but this time he wasn't even trying to curse. The other three times, the first three times, he gets up at a mountaintop and he looks at the Jewish people and he's trying to cast what we know as the Ayin Hara, the evil eye, on the Jewish people and to try to evoke a curse. And each time he opens his mouth, it's flipped and transformed into a blessing. So that's as far as the first three times. The fourth time, Balaam just says simply, I'm going to bless the people and take this opportunity to bless them. And he talks about the Messianic era. And it's, again, incredible prophecies. I have the first three. I don't have the fourth. But this is where the curses are transformed into blessings. Interestingly enough, again, another point of introduction, our sages tell us that if you look at the blessings closely, you can almost see what he wanted to say. Right? He wanted to curse the Jewish people, but he opened his mouth and those were transformed into blessings. He couldn't help himself because God put those blessings into his mouth. But from the blessings, you could almost discern what he wanted to say negatively about the Jewish people. So it's an interesting exercise. I don't think we're going to do that line by line, but just keep that in mind as we read this together. Also, final point of introduction, this is all part of the famous story where he goes on his journey to approach the consideration of whether to try to curse the Jewish people or not. This is the famous incident that he has with his donkey who starts talking. You know this story? So an angel appears before the donkey to stop him from even embarking on this journey, the prophet. And the donkey stops because the donkey sees the angel. Balaam, the great prophet, the big macher, right? He's the big guy, the guy for hire. So he doesn't see the angel. And so he gets upset at the donkey. He starts beating the donkey because the donkey is refusing to move forward. This happens a few times. And eventually the donkey turns around and says, "Excuse me, why are you hitting me? I've been your faithful donkey for many, many years. And I'm not stopping for no reason." And then God opened his eyes, the prophet, and he saw the angel and he felt like, you know, imagine if a donkey, you're the prophet, right? And the donkey sees more than you see, and the donkey can speak. And God's message was, you think you're so hot, you think you're so amazing. If I want, even a donkey can see more than you. So that was also a humbling message for him. He didn't get the message. I don't think he internalized it, because he proceeded to continue to try to curse the Jewish people and didn't work out. But it's a funny episode. You know, is that the inspiration for Shrek and the Talking Donkey? I would say yes, but anyway, it's a fascinating story on so many. This whole Torah portion is just so colorful. It's really, when you think about biblical comedy, it's one of those episodes that one could say is a little bit of comedic relief, where you have this guy who's really serious, that takes himself really seriously. You know, he's really, you know, into himself. And he can't see it. The donkey can see it. The donkey talks to him and really humbles him. It's a very, very, very interesting and almost humorous story. All right, let's begin. We're going to jump right into the text. Okay, here we go. This is the first blessing. He took up his parable and said. This is going to be said each time. He took up his parable. Why parable? So he didn't speak. Huh? A parable. Was that what that is? That's a parasol. Okay. He was having cocktails and he held up the little, no. So the parable means that he, basically the blessings were said in very poetic language and allegorical language. And that's basically what the Torah is highlighting. So he took up his parable and said, quote, "Balak, the king of Moab, has brought me from Aram, from the mountains of the east, saying, come curse Jacob for me and come invoke wrath against Israel." So that's what the request was, and now Balaam continues. "How can I curse whom God has not cursed? And how can I invoke wrath if the Lord has not been angered? For from their beginning I see them as mountain peaks, and I behold them as hills. It is a nation that will dwell alone and will not be reckoned among the nations. Who counted the dust of Jacob, or the number of a fourth, or of the seed of Israel? May my soul die the death of the upright, and let my end be like his." Far from cursing the Jewish people, he expresses tremendous blessings. Let's cover a few of the points that he mentions in that statement. He talks about simply the fact that he can't curse whom God has not cursed, and he cannot get God angry at those who God is not angry at. So he's expressing, even if it's against his will, he's expressing his limitations and a sense of humility in this process. Then he says, from the beginning, I see them as mountain peaks. And what that means, according to the commentaries, according to many commentaries, is he sees how the Jewish people begin with strong patriarchs and matriarchs. They begin with mountain peaks, with strong mountains, with fortitude and strength of their predecessors. A nation that dwells alone. The Jewish people are not afraid to go against the rest of civilization. When the rest of the world, you know, is involved in, you know, who knows what, the Jewish people don't mind being contrarians and don't mind being alone, obviously in a positive sense here, right? And alone in a moral and ethical stance. Yeah.
Yeah. Can you just comment on, I'm confused about, I
behold
them as hills.
Oh, so mountain peaks and hills, one is patriarchs and one is matriarchs. Right? So one is the patriarchs and one is the matriarchs. So that's that dual language, at least according to Rashi, one of the explanations. Again, nation that dwells alone, not be reckoned among the nations, means again the Jewish people are not so, they don't need to be popular. What's right is not popular, and what's popular is not always right. So it doesn't have to be, you know, Jews have always been a little bit different and unique and individualized. He talks about the numbers of the Jewish people, although the Jewish people are relatively small. They've always been relatively small. But he says, who counted the dust of Jacob or the number of the seed of Israel? I guess it's not only physical numbers, but also the type of impact that we've had upon the world. When you look at, you know, famously, there's a text that goes around every so often about how many Nobel Prizes Jews have won over the years versus the population, and it's whatever, whether it's literally there are so many Jews, or whether it's that the impact of Jewish people have been tremendous, you know, either way, he talks about the vastness of the Jewish people. Clearly it's a blessing. By the way, as soon as he wraps up this first blessing, this first series of blessings, so the king who hired him says, what are you doing? I hired you to curse the people and you're blessing them. And he says, hey, I already told you, I cannot go against the word of God. So if God is putting these words into my mouth, then that's it. Okay, let's jump into the second one. Second paragraph. He took up his parable and said, arise, Balak, and hear. Listen closely to me, son of Zippor. God is not a man that he should lie, nor is he a mortal that he should relent. Would he say and not do, speak and not fulfill? I have received an instruction to bless, and he has blessed, and I cannot retract it. He does not look at evil in Jacob and has seen no perversity in Israel. The Lord his God is with him and he has the king's friendship. God has brought them out of Egypt with the strength of his loftiness. For there is no divination in Jacob and no soothsaying in Israel. In time it will be said to Jacob and Israel, what has God wrought? Behold, a people that rises like a lioness and raises itself like a lion, it does not lie down until it eats its prey and drinks the blood of the slain. Lots of imagery here. Tremendous imagery. And again, if you want to study this in depth, so many classic Jewish commentaries explaining every word and every phrase of these blessings. Balak, this Torah portion that contains, again, four instances of prophecy and blessing from Balaam, from the evil prophet, it's one of the richest Torah portions in commentary because it has so many layers of depth. And it's not a literal, none of this is literal. Right, so there's so many different ways that it could be interpreted. I'll give you a simple, straightforward way of understanding it. Number one, the first point he says is, look, God says that he blesses the Jewish people. In general, God says they're my blessed people. So God doesn't change his mind. God doesn't lie and God doesn't relent. God's not like, oh, hey, I was just kidding. I don't bless them anymore. You can curse them. It's not how it works, Balaam is saying in a moment of truth and honesty. He says, I can't curse whom God has not cursed, and they're a blessed people, and that it can't be retracted. He does not look at evil in Jacob. He doesn't see perversity in Israel. In other words, even if there are blemishes, he doesn't necessarily focus on the bad. This is a truth in love that Kabbalah explains and other Jewish teachings explain at length, just kind of parenthetically, but it's not so parenthetical because we're talking about these blessings. When it comes to love, love covers over blemishes and flaws. That's the nature of love. Love is the ultimate, what do they call makeup? Concealer, right? There's concealer, right? Love is the ultimate, sorry, this was Kabbalah and cosmetics. You thought this was Kabbalah and coffee. Oh, it's a different class. No. Hey, so this is, so love is the ultimate concealer in that when you're in love, you don't see the flaws. And even if you do see something, you don't see it as a flaw. It's like a cute feature, right? You can look at something two ways. It's like, oh, it's a unique feature, or it's like, oh, it's irritating. That's a choice that we all make, right? Somebody does something that we don't do with the appliances, with the utility, whatever it is, right? In the house, they put something away a way that we don't do it. You can look at it two ways. Either, oh, that's interesting. That's an interesting way of doing it. Oh, I love that about them, that they're so unique and different. Or, oh, it drives me crazy, right? Oh my gosh, it's driving me sugar. It's so good, right? It's driving me bananas that they do this. Ultimately, it comes back to a choice of how to look at it. But one thing is for sure, when we're in love and you're feeling the love, not just when you're in a loving, committed relationship necessarily, that doesn't do this, but when you're feeling love towards someone, typically that masks those types of idiosyncrasies and those unique things, and it makes them into further points of love. So here he says that God doesn't see the evil in Israel. Even if the Jewish people aren't always perfect tzaddik and perfectly righteous, God doesn't look at it in such a as such a negative or terrible thing. That's what he says. Okay, then he continues. There's no divination in Jacob, no soothsaying in Israel. So basically the Jewish people are purely with God and they're not trying to game the system through divination and soothsaying and occult practices and black magic and these types of things like fortune telling and like none of this stuff is happening. The Jewish people are perfectly have the perfect faith with God. And then the final point that he says, which is a beautiful idea, a people that rises like a lioness and raises itself like a lion. Such a beautiful image. So my wife now, as some of you know, my wife and daughter, Reva, they're in South Africa. They're toward the end of an almost three-week excursion in South Africa. Leah's brother got married, so she went for the wedding and stayed a little bit longer. But they just went to the zoo in Johannesburg. And the zoo, you can get up close and personal with lions. And these lions, I mean, these are like the real deal. These are like, these are not like Americanized, like, you know what? Let me take chocolate. This is not like Americanized lions. These are, I don't know that there's such a thing as Americanized lions for the record, but nonetheless. But these are real African lions. And so she shot some video, Leah shot some video and sent it to me last week where it's feeding time for the lions. This is at the zoo. And like the, I don't know, lion keeper, I guess it's called, whatever, the lion keeper is getting the door ready to like put out, it's you have to be careful, I'm sure, when you're feeding a lion not to get too, right, not to give too much access. And so the lions you see are like scratching at the door. They kind of know what's going down. And then they give the meat and the lions are walking around. They pounce on it and then they walk around with like a big piece of meat in their mouth. It's like a fearsome thing. But if you know a little bit about lions, especially the male lions, they spend most of their time doing what? Lying around, hanging out. They're lying down in the sun or in the shade. That's pretty much what they're doing. Like if you go on the safari in South Africa or wherever, which I've done also when I was there last time, or not last time, but a few times ago, Kruger National Park. So you drive through and you know you're on a little dirt road and you have binoculars or whatever it is and you're trying to look for the animals. And it's not like they don't come up and like, hey, take a picture, let's do a photo op. It's not like that. They're in their element and you're trying to spot them. And so the lions are typically, you know, most of the day lying down. Here's the thing. When they're lying down, they look so innocent, so cute, like a big cat. Like what could go wrong? Right? What could go wrong? You know, we can even maybe pet the lion. But you know one thing. Even if the lion looks tame and timid and tranquil and placid right now, in a moment, the lion can rise with the full ferocity of the lion and be ready to pounce. And so Balaam uses this language when referring to the Jewish people. He says it's a people that rises like a lioness and raises itself like a lion. In other words, there are many different ways to understand this, but one way to understand it is what I'm saying, is that even when it looks like the soul is dormant and quiet, it can rise in a moment. It can rise and it can display its full glory. Even not in a dangerous sense, but in a beautiful sense. Like a lion lying down looks lazy and tired. But when a lion rises, it's majestic, right? It's got the thing, what is it called? The mane, right? It's got the full beard, the whole thing going on. Okay. So that's the second instance of Balaam's blessings. Let's do number three. He took up his parable and said, the word of Balaam... Oh, sorry. And once again, after the second instance, Balak, the king, who's paying him good money, he says, what are you doing? You out of your mind? And he says, look, I can only do what God tells me to say. All right, third. He took up his parable and said, the word of Balaam, the son of Baar, and the word of the man with an open eye. He called himself the man with the open eye. You know, you have like images like a third eye or whatever it is. So he had like the open eye about himself because he could see things. The word of the one who hears God's sayings, who sees the vision of the Almighty, fallen yet with open eyes. He used to have prophecy lying down. So fallen, but with open eyes. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. They extend like streams, like gardens by the river, like aloes which the Lord planted, like cedars by the water. Water will flow from his wells, and his seed shall have abundant water. His king shall be raised over Agag, and his kingship exalted. God, who has brought them out of Egypt with the strength of his loftiness, he shall consume the nations which are his adversaries, bare their bones, and dip his arrows into their blood. He crouches and lies like a lion, and like a lioness, who will dare rouse him? Those who bless you shall be blessed, and those who curse you shall be cursed. So let's go over this series of blessings again, just very quickly. Again, he calls himself the man with the open eye, a person that has vision, who communicates with God Almighty, etc. And then he talks about, as he begins his blessing, how goodly are your tents, O Jacob. You should know that these words are immortalized in Jewish prayer. One of the first things in the Jewish prayer book in the Siddur that we say every morning is this line, Matovu Ohalecha Yaakov Mishkan Osecha Yisrael. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. It says he was standing on top of a mountain or a hilltop, looking at the Jewish encampment, and he saw something that blew him away. He saw that the Jews, when they would encamp in the wilderness, they wouldn't put tents, they lived in tents, they wouldn't put their tents opposite each other, they would stagger them. Why would they stagger them? Because if you put two tents facing each other, that means it could be that the doorways, the openings are facing each other, and that takes away from the privacy of the tents, even though you can pack them in. Well, I guess if you stagger, that's also, but either way. So they wouldn't put them opposite each other. They would stagger the tents, the openings of the tents wouldn't be facing each other. So Balaam sees this, and he says, Matovo Olecha Yaakov, how goodly are your tents, O Israel, your dwelling places. How goodly are your tents, O Jacob, your dwelling places, O Israel. There's this privacy, there's this notion of respect for others and respect for self, etc. Then he talks about they extend like streams, like gardens by the river, water will flow from his wells, his king shall be raised over Agag. Okay, it talks about the Jews' victory over other nations and superiority over other nations, etc. Okay, fine. So that is that. And then he invokes the imagery of the lion and says clearly, who will dare rouse him? You know, even when a lion is lying down, it's probably not good form to wake up the lion. And he concludes with, those who bless you, the Jewish people shall be blessed, and those who curse you shall be cursed. And then it concludes, this episode concludes with Balak getting very angry. Here we go. Second side of the handout. Balak's anger flared against Balaam, and he clapped his hands. You kind of see that imagery where he gets so upset, he doesn't know what to say. So he just claps his hands, like not out of excitement, but out of frustration. Balak said to Balaam, I called you to curse my enemies, but you have blessed them these three times. No payday for you, he says. You're not getting paid. Forget about it. Forget the advance that I may have given you in advance, but don't expect the balance. And it's after this that he's been fired from his position. Balaam goes ahead and does a fourth round of blessings that are not being commissioned as curses, that have transformed into blessings, but straight up blessings. And again, in that fourth series, which I didn't cite here, he talks about the Messianic era and the future time, the days to come. The point of all of this is that oftentimes blessings come from the most unexpected of places. You know, again, you would think that this fellow, who's an enemy, or at least being hired to be an enemy of the Jewish people, he would be the one who's cursing the Jewish people, and he intended to curse the Jewish people. And yet, from this low place, from this lowly individual, from this terrible situation, emerges some of the greatest blessings. Very interesting. You know the backstory, the origin story of Balaam in Egypt? I may have mentioned this at a previous class. Pharaoh, when he was figuring out what to do with the Jewish problem in his times, right? Pharaoh of enslavement, Jewish enslavement fame. So he gathered three advisors to consult with. They were Balaam, Job, and Jethro. So Bilam, Eiv, Job, and Yisro, Jethro. He had three advisors in the room, and he said to them, what do we do? The Jews are populating. There's a lot of them. You know, there's a certain fear here. What are they going to do to the country from the inside out, etc.? And so Balaam is the one who came up with the plan to kill the babies, kill the Jewish babies. Kill the babies, throw the boys into the Nile River, etc. That was Balaam's idea. Yisro, Jethro, he said, how dare you? Terrible, cruel idea. You can't do this. Job remained silent. Job didn't say anything, according to this Midrashic teaching. He didn't say anything, and he didn't protest. But either way, Balaam is the one who came up with that idea against the Jewish people. So it seems that he wasn't just being hired to curse the Jewish people, and he was a mercenary for a prophet mercenary for hire. So yeah, he just did it for the money. It seems like he had a long-lived antagonism toward the Jewish people. Okay, so that's, again, one instance of unexpected blessings. Let's now segue over to the Talmud. The Talmud tells a story that is incredible. So the author of the Zohar was Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai was a great Talmudic sage, well, actually a Mishnaic sage, a sage from the times of the Mishnah, who was a great mystic and a great halachist as well. He was very proficient in both the revealed parts of Torah and the hidden parts of Torah. He famously had to run away from the Romans who wanted to kill him, and he hid in a cave for 12 years with his son, and then he stayed another year with his son. And it was on his deathbed that he taught a lot of the secrets of Torah that have been immortalized in the work of the Zohar, the Book of Radiance, which is one of the primary works of Kabbalah. So the story goes, the Talmud tells a story about Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, this great rabbi, who said to his son to get a blessing from two individuals and how that story unfolds. So I'm going to read the story, and you'll see how strange it is. Remember, our theme is unexpected blessings. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai said to his son, these two people, Rabbi Yonatan ben Asmai and Rabbi Yehuda, son of converts, are men of noble form, which means that they are very wise and learned individuals. So Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai tells his son, go to them so that they will bless you. He went, so the son went, and found them deep in discussion, raising apparent contradictions between verses. So they were involved in very scholarly discussion. And that went on, the Talmud, I put the dot, 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 because the Talmud then goes on for a while discussing what they were discussing as the Rashbi, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's son, is kind of waiting for his blessing, but meanwhile they're having this great Talmudic discussion. When Rabbi Yochanan ben Asmai and Rabbi Yehuda noticed Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai's son, so after a while they noticed him kind of lurking in the shadows, so they said to him, what do you want here? He said to them, Father told me, go to them so that they should bless you. He basically said, I'm here to get a blessing. My father said to come here for a blessing, for a bracha. They said to him as follows. So here's the blessing that they give him. Listen to this. May it be God's will that you should sow and not reap, that you should bring in and not take out, that you should take out and not bring in, that your house should be destroyed and your lodging place should be inhabited, that your table should become confused, and that you should not see a new year. How does that sound to you?
It's nice.
Like a curse.
Total curse. So look what happens. When he came back to his father, he said to him, not only did they not bless me, but they even caused me pain with their negative words. In other words, you sent me to get a bracha from these two scholars, to get a blessing. Not only did they not bless me, but they cursed me. And they cursed me in a hurtful way. Look at the text. May it be God's will that you should sow, you should plant and not reap. You should invest in things and never see any blessing from it. Terrible. House should be destroyed. You shouldn't see a new year. Who says such things? So look what, remember who his father was. Who was his father? One of the greatest Kabbalists that ever lived. Rashbi, the author of the Zohar, the Book of Radiance. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
Does he have to know the name back?
Rashbi. Rashbi. Well, Rashbi is the acronym for Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. So listen, Rashbi says to his son, you didn't understand what they said. They didn't curse you. They blessed you. But you have to know how to hear it. So his father said to him, what exactly did they say to you? He says, Before you jump to conclusions and say definitively that they cursed you, tell me what they said. So he answered, they said to me such and such. So he repeated to his father, word for word, what these two rabbis and scholars said to him. Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai said to his son, these are all blessings uttered in a cryptic cryptic manner. And this is what they meant. You ready for this? I just want to point out something. This is going to be a truth in life. We all encounter things in life that feel like curses, that feel like someone or something or maybe God has it out for us. This is not just a conversation between the Rashbi and his son. This is an internal dialogue that we can have with ourselves. Is this really a curse? Or perhaps can I look inside and find the blessing therein? It's an incredible message in life. But let's see how it plays out in this story. When they said that you should sow and not reap, they meant that you should bear children, you should bear sons, and they should not die. You should sow and not reap, right? You shouldn't take them back. Have children that will live and live long lives. They should not die before you. Their statement that you should bring in and not take out means that you should bring in brides for your sons, and your sons should not die, which would cause their wives to leave. Right? Your daughters-in-law should not become widows because your sons are dying prematurely. When they said you should take out and not bring in, they meant that you should have daughters, and their husbands should not die, which would cause your daughters to return back home to you. You see what's going on here? Every statement was a blessing. Your children should live. Your daughters-in-law should have their husbands. Your daughters should have their husbands. Everyone should live long and prosper, right? When they said that your house should be destroyed and your lodging place should be inhabited, right, let's understand that literally. It means that your house should be destroyed. Aye. And your lodging place, like the cabin, you should have to move in to the cabin, which I'm sure back then wasn't a cabin and wasn't even, right? Not a cabin and not a cabin. It was, you know, a lodging place is like, have to stay at a hotel somewhere. Terrible curse, right? Slow it down. This should be interpreted allegorically as well. As this world is compared to your lodging place and the world to come is compared to your house, right? The sages gave Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai's son a blessing that he should dwell in his temporary home rather than his permanent home, i.e. he should live a long life in this world. This world is compared to temporary lodgings. The world to come, right? The afterlife is the permanent home. That's where the soul spends most of its time quantitatively. And yet the blessing of these rabbis to Rabbi Elazar, the son of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, was that he should live a long life, ba'olam hazen, this world, to do lots of mitzvot, physical mitzvot, live a long life here, so that the world to come, not that it should be destroyed, that it should be, in the Hebrew, we have to work with wording, it doesn't mean that they shouldn't have a world to come. What it means is that the world to come should wait a while, and that he should enjoy, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's son, should enjoy a long life here on earth. This reflects a truth in Judaism that we're not living to escape, right? We're not living here to get out and to get to some other destination. The tachlis, the purpose is right here now. Let's continue. When they said that your table should become confused, that's also like, oh, who says that? They meant that you should be blessed with many sons and daughters, so that there will be noise and confusion at their table. Right?
I like this one.
How cute is that? Right? It's like your house should be a wreck, right? In a good way, right? Okay. When they said that you should not see a new year, look at this. When they said that you should not see a new year, it's like, how do you explain this one now? They meant that your wife should not die, and as a result, you should not have to marry another woman, about which it says, when a man has taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war, neither shall he be charged with any business. He shall be free at home for 1 year. The Torah says in Deuteronomy that when a person gets married, then they're off from civil duty for a year. You give them a year to spend with their new bride. So what it means, when they said that you should not see a new year, what they meant is you shouldn't need to remarry and then have a new year, which you're not allowed to participate in certain communal activities. You with me on this? Your wife should be healthy, you should be healthy, your wife should be healthy, and you shouldn't need to, she shouldn't pass away, God forbid, that would require you to marry and then have a new year of abstention from like civil duty and, you know, jury duty or military duty or whatever it is. So here's how Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai explains it. A series of 5 or 6, maybe even 7, I wasn't counting, maybe 6 different statements that seem like total curses, one after the other. Terrible stuff. And the Rashbi says, this great mystic, this Kabbalist says, you don't understand. These are the greatest blessings. Here's the question, though. The obvious question. If they wanted to bless him, help me out with the question. If they wanted to bless him, why didn't they just say it? Why did they have to say it in such a cryptic manner? Was it because, you know, that's what mystics do? They kind of couch blessings in cryptic language? Is it that they wanted to play around with him, like, you know, he's a young guy, so they wanted to throw him something that he'd be confused and he would have to get it explained? If their intention was really to bless, why didn't they just say, you should have sons and they should live long? You should have daughters and their husbands should live long. Your sons, when they get married, should live long. You should live a long life here. You should have your wife should... Why didn't they just say it? They could have just said the blessing straight up. They had to say it in a cryptic fashion that he needed to be interpreted. So here's where Kabbalah comes in. You guys ready for this? Kabbalah explains that the higher the blessing, the more spiritual resistance there is for the blessing to come down. That's the nature of opposition, divinely orchestrated opposition in this world. The way it works, everything comes from above. But the way God created it is that things are in balance. Ze l'umat ze asa Elokim. God created one opposite the other. The universe exists in balance. So whenever there's something powerfully positive, there's also something powerfully negative. It's balanced out. If at any point in time there was more a natural goodness in the world, it would make it too easy for people to do good, which would make good less meaningful to be done because it's so easy to do good, which would make it less of a challenge and a test. And that's not what God wanted. If at any point in time there was more evil in the world, so it would make it harder to do good, which would turn the tables against the person choosing good and would make doing bad too easy. And that also wouldn't be fair. So everything is always in perfect balance between good and the opposite of good. So the way it works is that anytime there's something like a blessing or something positive that's coming down the pipeline, so to speak, the spiritual pipeline, or anytime that goodness is done, there's always going to be an opposition, either to oppose it with something negative or to try to block that blessing from materializing. So the way the Kabbalists explain it is, when there's a blessing that is getting ready to come down from above, that's a really tremendous blessing, like a very lofty light. So the forces of opposition, which God created, right? The force of opposition muster their own strength to block it. Now these great sages, the two sages that the Rashbi sent his son to be blessed by, so these two great sages were also mystics. They knew this. And they knew that there's one way that you can get a tremendous blessing by undetected. How? How? How do you get great light pass through without getting blocked by the forces of opposition? If you take the light and do what with it? You hide it. You put it in a cover that it doesn't look like light anymore. In other words, you smuggle it in, straight up. Right? Because if you're trying to bring in a bunch of light into this world, you're going to get a lot of spiritual opposition from the other forces. So how do you bring tremendous light and blessing? A blessing is bringing light into the world. How do you bring tremendous light into the world? You have to smuggle it in. It's like putting a diamond or a wad of cash in a cereal box. I don't know. Anybody do that? Why would somebody do that? I have no idea. I'm not, by the way, this is not the Kabbalah of smuggling. This is not, if anybody's watching, this is not a thing. We're not, you know, this is not Kabbalah and criminology. That's not what this is. But the point is that if you want to bring something that's tremendously valuable in somewhere undetected, it probably helps to put it in a case, in a cover, that doesn't look so precious and valuable. That way you throw people off the trail, right? You smuggle it in. Straight up.
That also reminds me, like the old curse. I remember Rabbi Sindina, she said, I think it's Rabbi Schusterman's father who wrote the book, you know, the famous book from Rabbi Kushner, Why.
What a bad thing. Bad things
happen to good people, and he wrote Why. Do bad thing happen to good people.
Right.
So I think about that a lot, knowing that curse, that's what the dad's.
Right. Is it bad? How do we define it? Exactly. Yeah, exactly. So the way Kabbalah explains this episode is that these great sages, they didn't want to bless the son of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai in a straightforward way. Because then the blessing would have been met by opposition and it might not have materialized 100%. Because the forces of negativity would have heard such blessings and said, not so fast, we're going to try to derail the blessings, and they would have, right? It sounds a little bit petty and trivial the way I'm expressing it, but this is basically more or less, you know, I'm oversimplifying it, but that's kind of the way the spiritual forces work. So if there's a lot of light that's obviously coming in, there's going to be a lot of opposition to try to push it out or deflect it. But when these rabbis said these words, the force of opposition are like, yeah, we can get on board with this. We like that. Shouldn't live another year. Shouldn't live to see another year, a new year. Love it. It's great. We're letting it through customs. Yeah, you can go by, no problem. Oh, that's a box of cereal. Bring it in. Right? Meanwhile, the intention deep down was the greatest blessings. This is how the Alter Rebbe, the founder of Chabad, this is how the Alter Rebbe explains this story. And this is how he explains the instances in Torah where we find the curses. For example, Moses' curses. There are 49 curses that are uttered in the Torah, in the book of Leviticus, and 98 in the book of Deuteronomy. And the context is, the Jewish people, if you don't do what you need to do, then this terrible calamity will befall you, and this terrible calamity, and that suffering, and that tragedy, and that misfortune, one after the other, 49, and then doubled in Deuteronomy, 98. And there's a story. The story goes that the Tzemach Tzedek, no, it wasn't the Tzemach Tzedek, it was the Mittler Rebbe, the second Chabad Rebbe, when he was a child, Rabbi Dov Ber, when he was 11 or 12, I don't know, he was a fairly young boy. So one year, in the Deuteronomy, the 98 curses, he heard the curses, as the Torah describes them, and he became so frightened by the curses. I mean, you could look them up, it's terrible stuff, terrible. Talks about cannibalism, like parents having no money, so they eat their children. I mean, terrible stuff. Horrific curses and punishments and whatever. And he heard, he was so affected by what he heard that he became physically ill, seriously sick. This child became sick, physically sick, to the point that when Yom Kippur came around a few weeks later, there was a question if he was allowed to fast. I don't think he was yet bar mitzvah, but he was already starting to fast a little bit. The question was he even physically clear by the doctors to fast because he was so ill from hearing these curses a few weeks before? So somebody asked him, they said, you hear this every year. So why don't you get sick every year? I mean, it's never happened before. So he said, usually, my father, the Alter Rebbe, my father reads the Torah. And when father reads, one doesn't hear curses. One only hears the blessings. The Alter Rebbe, his father, indeed taught in Likutei Torah, in his book on explaining the mystical interpretation of the Torah, that follows the order of the Torah portions, he explains that the curses in the Torah are really the greatest blessings in disguise. And he uses this story of the Talmud that I just cited, of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. He uses that as the case study. He says, look at this story in the Talmud. Here you have words that seem like curses. But the Rashbi was able to explain how they're not just not curses, but they're the greatest blessings. So the Alter Rebbe says the same thing is true in Torah. Yeah, on the surface level, a simple reading of Torah, it seems like these are horrific curses, but when you look at it through a mystical, through a deeper lens, these are the greatest blessings. And sometimes the greatest light can only come through a vessel that looks the opposite of light. The greatest blessings can only come into the world through a vessel, through a conduit, through words, through language that encases it in that which is diametrically opposed to the blessing itself. So you put the gem, the beautiful jewel, into a very plain case so that no one would know, so that no one knows what's really going on inside. So the beautiful light is encased and you can't see it. You have to know how to unpack it. The point here is, though, following along the theme of unexpected blessings, this is a theme that's consistent in Torah with the prophet Balaam. It's consistent in the Talmud with the story of Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and his son. It's consistent in the Torah when it comes to the curses and the punishments that are stated in the Torah, which, according to Kabbalah and Hasidus, can be understood as the greatest blessings. Blessings, sometimes, oftentimes, come from the most unexpected of places. And the way I'm explaining it now, it's almost like the greatest blessings can only come through the most unexpected of places because they couldn't come through expected places. You couldn't have a blessing come through in a straightforward fashion. It had to come through a very complicated way. Do you know the lineage of King David? So complicated. So complicated. Right? He is the product of multiple questionable relationships on various levels. And he had his own questionable relationships, right? With, huh? Right, so you have this whole history of like, well, Judah and Tamar, he thought she was supposed to marry one of his sons, and she dressed up like a harlot, and he had a relationship with her, and he didn't know who she was because she had covered her. And then it turns out that she was his former daughter-in-law. His sons had married her, and they had died, so she was a widow. But she was set to marry the third son. She had married two of them, and they died. And now she was set to marry the third one, but hadn't married yet. But then she dressed up like a woman, like a harlot, and he didn't know. He had a relationship with her, and then he was going to kill her because he found out that she was pregnant. He didn't know it was from him. And this is the lineage of King David. From that questionable, and a few times throughout history, we have questionable relationships that are like, you look at it, it's like, that great person that we respect in Torah, that we respect in Scripture, did that, and then those kids were, and that's King David, and that's King Solomon, and that's the predecessor of Mashiach, the Messiah. It's like, oh yeah, how does that work? Kabbalah says, to smuggle in the greatest light, it's got to come through questionable means because it can't come through in a straightforward fashion. You can't bring down the soul of a King David of the Messianic lineage in an ordinary, straightforward, holy fashion. It has to come through a little bit of a complicated way. It's got to be a complicated story. Because you can't smuggle it. The light is too bright to just be like, all right, folks, just clear out the way. We're bringing in all this light on this huge truck. Guys, I was driving the other day in Cobb County, and there was like a police escort. I'm like, what's the police escort? And I see they were driving this massive, house, building? Mm-hmm. They're transporting an actual building. It's not unusual. You see it on highways, house, but this is yeah, house or whatever. Can yeah, like a modular. Yeah. Oh, can you? That's awesome. We'll just put it down like right here. Yeah, it's good. Just drop it. So it's not like you can bring in the light, the messianic light. Like, okay, folks, clear out the way. Police escort, we're bringing in the light. There's going to be way too much opposition. Way too much. You're never going to get it through. You're going to have the forces of negativity that are like, not on our watch, not over our dead bodies, which they're considered dead because they're not really, whatever. But they're like, but they're not going to let it in. It's not going to go through. So it has to come through, you know, questionable, well, apparently on the surface, what looks like questionable means. That's how you smuggle in the light. So you have this theme that pervades Jewish scripture and Kabbalah, this idea that the blessings, the greatest blessings, come through the most curious channels and the most unexpected methods. Okay, let's continue. More stories of unexpected blessings. Again, from the Talmud. This pertains to a fellow whose name was Nachum. His name was Nachum. Nachum. And they called him Nachum Ish Gam Zu. That was his nickname. Well, Nachum was his name, but they called him Ish, which means the man, of Gam Zu. What's Gam Zu? I know the Johannesburg Zoo, but what's the Gam Zu? No. What's Gam Zu? Gam Zu in Hebrew means? Also this. Gam is also or and. Gamzu, also this. What does it mean that Nachum was the man of also this? He said, he would always say, also this is for the good. No matter what happened to him, he said, this too is a blessing. Gamzu letova. This also is good. This also is good. This also is good. The Talmud traces the origins of his name. Here we go. Weapons. Why did they call Nachum, why did they call him Nachum of Gamzu? The reason is that with regard to any matter that occurred to him, he would say, this too is for the good. Gamzu letova. This too is for the good. Once, listen to this story. Such a wild story. Once, the Jews wished to send a gift to the house of the emperor. Now you have to understand, the Jews at this time lived under the rule of the emperor. Perhaps, not perhaps, it was the Roman emperor. And when you live under the rule of the emperor, there's two options. Either you can be that nation that's always like, you know, needling the emperor, and then, you know, bad times might happen, which is eventually what caused the destruction of the temple. Or you can pay tribute and, you know, honor the emperor, even if you don't believe in the emperor, but, you know, you're just doing your thing to, you know, to sustain your life and viability. Okay. So the Jews wish to send the gift to the house of the emperor. They said, who should go and present the gift? Let Nachum of Gamzu go, as he is accustomed to miracles. This guy, he like, you know, he's always blessed. So he's a good guy to take this treasure chest of riches to the emperor. They sent him with a chest full of jewels and pearls. And he went and spent the night at a certain inn. What do you think happened at the inn? This Jewish guy with a chest of pearls. What do you think? Yeah, right? Right, so what happens? During the night, the residents of the inn arose, either it's the residents or the innkeeper, whatever, yeah. They arose and took all the precious jewels and pearls from the chest and instead filled it with earth. So look, this guy, what does he know? He's a tzaddik. He's like living in a different plane. He has this chest filled with tremendous jewels and pearls and the whole tremendous wealth in this box. He comes in. You know, can I get a room? No problem. They come in, middle of the night, they break into the box and they take out the stuff. I'm sure he didn't put it in the safe. They didn't have a safe, right? So they broke in, they took out the stuff and they filled it with earth and they closed it back up. He didn't know, he had no clue. He had no clue. The next day when he saw, he did know. The next day when he saw what had happened, so he realized what Nachum of Gamzu said, I mean, he went back to his line. This too is for the good. He didn't say, how dare you? Who are the thieves? I mean, the thieves presumably had vanished and, you know, they were off in Vegas. But that's, the point is that he said, realizing what had happened, Gamzu Latova. He was Nachum Ish Gamzu for a reason. Gamzu Latova, this too is for the good. When he arrived there at the ruler's palace, they opened the chest and saw that it was filled with earth. He says, on behalf of the Jewish people, we pay tribute to you and bring you a gift. And they open it up, and what is in it? Dirt. Okay, that's not a good look. The king wished to put all the Jewish emissaries to death. He said, the Jews are mocking me. Nachum of Gamzu said, probably to himself, this too is for the good. It'll work out. Elijah the prophet now steps in. Elijah the prophet came and appeared before the ruler as one of his ministers. He said to the ruler, perhaps this earth is from the earth of their father Abraham. As when he threw earth, this story goes, Midrashic story, when Abraham threw earth, it turned into swords. And when he threw stubble, it turned into arrows. As it is written, his sword makes them as the dust, his bow as the driven stubble, from Isaiah. We say that's referring to Abraham. Basically, remember when Abraham tried to rescue his nephew Lot, and he got involved in this regional war between four kings and five kings, whatever, it was a massive war that went on, but Abraham's nephew was somehow involved, he got pulled into it, and he was taken as a prisoner of war. So Abraham says, that's it, I'm going in, and he goes into battle, and he destroyed the four kings were stronger than the five, the four nations against the five. The four were overpowering, and they captured Lot and others. And then Abraham went, and he almost single-handedly defeated the four nations. Well, how did he do it? So according to the Medrash, he took dirt, and he threw it. And as he threw it, you know, you pick up dirt and you throw it, there's a lot of particles that go flying. They all turn into arrows and swords in the air. So he picked it up and threw it, and it went, it destroyed entire swaths of enemy. So Elijah the prophet says to the king, you know, he somehow becomes one of the advisors now. He says to the king, hey, maybe it's earth that is miraculous earth, like Abraham's earth. So the story continues. There was one province that the Romans were, up until that point, unable to conquer. There's one, the Roman Empire wanted to get one piece of land in it. They just couldn't conquer that province. So now, with this new earth weaponry in hand, they took some of this earth, tested it by throwing it at their enemies, and conquered that province. When the ruler saw that this earth indeed had miraculous powers, his servant entered the treasury and filled Nachum of Gamzu's chest with precious jewels and pearls and set them off with great honor. Thus, Gamzu Litova, that too was for the good. It all worked out. So we have another example of unexpected blessings, where blessings come from curious places. And finally, the last text of unexpected blessings comes from the great Rabbi Akiva. Very famous story. I'm sure some of you have heard this already. Rabbi Akiva was walking along the road and came to a certain city. He inquired about lodging, and they did not give him any. They said, sorry, no vacancies. He said, everything that God does for the best. He had a similar refrain also. Whatever God does, it's for the good. He went and slept in a field, and he had with him a rooster, a donkey, and a candle. A gust of wind came and extinguished the candle. A cat came and ate the rooster. And a lion came and ate the donkey. He said, everything that God does, he does for the best. That night an army came and took the city into captivity. It turned out that Rabbi Akiva alone, who was not in the city and had no lit candle, noisy rooster, or donkey to give away his location, was saved. He said to them, I guess his students, didn't I tell you? Everything that God does, he does for the best. Now, how does that explain how the people of the city got captured? I don't know, right? We don't understand all of God's ways and why those people had to suffer, whatever it is. But the point is, for Rabbi Akiva himself, he was spared a terrible fate at that point in time because of things that happened that seemed to not be a blessing that turned out to be a blessing. So the point is, in life, oftentimes, things happen and they don't look like blessings. And they look like the opposite of blessings, whether it's somebody tells us something, like Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai's son, or somebody harms us, somebody robs us. Like Nachum Ish Gamzu was robbed, straight up. He was robbed. And that's not a good thing. There's no way that that's a good thing. It was a good thing for him. Go figure. For him, it was good. But he had that attitude that it was going to be for the good. Rabbi Akiva gets shut out from a city. He loses his belongings. this will be for the good. And it is for the good. The point is that we are very ill-equipped. We are unable. We're just simply not able to effectively define things as good or not good. We're not qualified to do so. But one thing we know, that if we have faith, if we have faith in God, and we believe that everything that God does is for the good, and this too is, even if it's just on a simple level, a learning experience, I will never work with that person again. Even if it's on that level, there's still a blessing that can come. At least now I know who they are. And so, I don't mean to minimize it to that point, to that takeaway. But the point is, there's always some sort of blessing that can be taken from what we encounter in life. The larger point, though, is that the way things work, the way the mechanics of the universe work, the way Kabbalah explains the mechanics of the universe, that which appears, that which looks like it's not going to be a blessing, or there's no way that any good is going to come from this, Kabbalah teaches, that might be the greatest source of blessing in your life. The greatest blessings often come, maybe always come, from the most unexpected of places. And it's not just unexpected, like, oh, surprise, you know, you won $1 million. It's not just unexpected because it's surprising. It's unexpected because it looked like the opposite of blessing. It looked like a low thing, and now it's the highest thing. In Kabbalah, there's a certain mechanic that repeats itself. And that is that what appears to be the lowest is in fact the highest. This is something when you study Kabbalah, you see it again and again and again. That which appears at first glance, second glance, third glance, that which appears to be the lowest is in fact, in truth, the highest. So for example, in the mystical Sefirot, 10 divine energy emanations, Chachma, Bina, Dat, Chesed, Gevura, Teferet, Netzach, Hod, Yesod, Malchut. 10 divine points of energy. The lowest is Malchut. And Malchut appears to be the last and the lowest, the most insignificant. In fact, it says in Kabbalah that Malchut, les lo megar meklum, it doesn't have anything of its own. It doesn't have its own light. It's like the moon that reflects light. Moon, when the moon shines at night, it doesn't have its own light. We're approaching, today is the 11th day of the month of Tammuz. So a full moon is always the middle of the Jewish month, because the Jewish months go by the lunar cycle. So the first of the month, of the Jewish month, is always, the moon is, you know, the smallest, almost non-existent. Or the first of the month is actually when the moon reappears as a sliver in the sky. The 15th, the middle of the month, 14th, 15th, is always a full moon. And the end of the month, again, it wanes again and almost disappears from the sky. The point is, when you see the moon on the 15th or 14th of the month, and it looks so beautiful and luminescent in the sky, and it's majestic and it's amazing, we know this, the moon doesn't have its own light. It's not a luminary. The moon doesn't shine. The moon reflects light, it doesn't shine. So, the Kabbalists say that Malchut, the lowest of the 10 energies, Malchut, which means kingship or sovereignty or royalty, leadership, Malchut doesn't have its own light. And that could mean, that seems to mean, that Malchut is the lowest. It's the lowest, the most insignificant. All of the other energies, the 9 previous energies, they're shining, they're radiating love and ambition and wisdom. All of these wonderful energies are shining. And then you have Malchut. What's Malchut? Nothing. Doesn't have anything. Garnish, nothing. Just receives, recipient, passive. And then Kabbalah says, oh, what appears to be the lowest is really the highest. Whoops, forgot to tell you. Sorry. What appears to be number 10 is really number 1. You flip the whole thing on its head. The lowest is the highest. Malchut, the lowest. It's called royalty for a reason. It's the keter, it's the crown to the next dimension. Malchut is at the top. Kingship, the lowest, is the highest. The earth, we've talked about this many times, the earth, everyone steps on the earth. We just had a story about the earth turning into weapons. But the earth, the physical earth, you walk on the ground. It's like the lowest, you tread on it, you don't even feel, no one feels sorry. You step on a piece of clothing, oh, I'm so sorry, I stepped on clothing, let me shake it out, I feel bad, right? You step on a chair in a room, every time I need to turn off the ceiling fans, and I step in a chair, I feel bad stepping on a chair. It's like I have to dust it off now. No one ever dusted off the earth. I know it wouldn't make any sense. I'm with you. But like, you step on the earth and there's no regret, right? There's no, so sorry for stepping on you. It's like, no, you're the earth. You deserve to be stepped on. Kabbalah teaches that which is the lowest, the earth, is really the highest. Life exists. Life is sustained because the earth produces vegetation. Nothing exists without the earth's blessing. Life could not be sustained without plants and trees and vegetables and fruit, which all grow from the ground. Oxygen, food, nothing could exist. Life wouldn't be sustained without the earth. So Kabbalah teaches what is the lowest is the highest. And the greatest blessings come from the most unexpected of places. Because it's malchut. Passive recipient malchut. Such a quiet malchut. I remember malchut from high school. It was always so quiet. Malchut. Here's the yearbook picture. So quiet. Malchut became such a big thing. Never saw it. Never was never the hotshot in school. I'm kidding, right? Malchut is always seems the lowest. And it's really the highest. It's the closest to God. Because growth and birth is a godly thing. It's a godly feature. Malchut, the lowest, reflects, it has godly features. In relationships, men and women are like, remember the famous book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus? So in Kabbalah, it's men are from Zah, women are from Malchut. So Zah refers to the energies preceding Malchut. It's collectively the six previous emotive energies, and Malchut, of course, is number 10. There's three intellectual, six emotional, and then Malchut. So men are from Zah, women are from Malchut. Malchut appears, right? It appears to be the recipient, right? Even biologically, right? When it comes to childbirth, etc., it seems like, at least in the process of conception, you have a giver and a receiver. And yet, where does life begin? Who creates life? Who births life? It's Malchut. It's the recipient. That which might appear, and historically, we know the gender roles historically. How men have taken the role of more dominant and have, you know, used that as leverage or whatever, and women have been less dominant. Kabbalah says, are you kidding me? Are you serious? Women, and this is, the feminine energy is actually higher than the masculine energy. Malchut, the recipient, is the source of all the blessings. So, talk about unexpected blessings. You know, where do the blessings come from? Yeah, it would seem like Zal would be the source of the blessings. It's Malchut that's the source of the blessings. Life happens from the earth. Birth happens from the mother, not from the father. Shabbat seems like it's the seventh day of the week. It's the recipient of all the other days. 6 days a week you shall work, and the seventh day you rest. It's passive. Kabbalah comes along and says, passive. Shabbat is passive. Whatever you did in the previous 6 days, you can enjoy passively on Shabbat. It's just a day to reflect and unwind. It's passive. What kind of passive? It's a day that blesses the next week. Shabbat is not just a day that absorbs and takes in and enjoys passively what you did before it. Shabbat gives you strength and energy and clarity for the week ahead. It's a gift, it's a blessing that's paid forward. It's not just the tail end of what existed prior, the lowest and last of what existed before it, it's the crown of what follows it. And with this, we'll conclude our discourse, The Majestic Bride. The whole point of this discourse was to describe relationships, marriage, Shabbat, and the weekday, the relationship between Mashpia and Mekabel, giver and recipient. And when it comes to any giver-recipient relationship, the obvious perspective is, well, giver is greater than recipient, and that's why they're the giver and they're the recipient, right? If you had to rank giver and recipient, you would say that giver stands above the recipient. And that makes sense in every single model. In every model, teacher and student, benefactor and beneficiary, it's always the same thing. The one who's giving is greater than the one who's receiving. And that's why they're giving and they're receiving. If the one who's receiving is greater, then they should be giving. So in every model, giver is seen as greater than the recipient, but not in Kabbalah. Kabbalah teaches that malchut, the recipient, and that which it seems to be, malchut, the recipient, which appears to be lower or less than, is actually flipped. It's actually greater than. And it's seen on every single level, including relationships, days of the week, when it comes to childbirth and children. On every single level, we see in Kabbalah the superiority of the malchut, the feminine, the recipient, over the giver. Page 50 in the text. This is again the previous Rebbe's discourse that he said at the wedding of the Rebbe in 1929. This is the last paragraph of the discourse, and he gets back to the opening verse. The opening verse is from the Licha Dodi prayer, and again, just to reset that verse, it says Licha Dodi, come my beloved, Likrat Kala, to meet the bride. So we say, come my beloved, to meet the bride, referring to Shabbat. Pinei Shabbat, the face of Shabbat, Nikabla, let us receive. So there's two things being said. Let us greet the Shabbat, the bride, and then it says, we'll receive the face of Shabbat. So here he explains it. Page 50, a woman's blessing. This then is the meaning of come my beloved to meet the bride. It is the giver drawing close to the receiver to create an external connection so that ultimately the receiver will be ready for the deeper internal connection. In other words, there's a process between giver and receiver, and we've talked about this in previous sessions, where, for example, in teaching, you start with a joke, you engage the students. So if you're the giver, you have to kind of create that relationship before you give. So you create the relationship, and then you give. But here's the punchline. But through this internal connection, then the giver actually gains from the receiver. As it says, let us welcome the Shabbat, i.e. receive from Shabbat. So you're in a sense giving to Shabbat, and then you can receive from Shabbat. And how does this work? Because all of the days of the subsequent week, as I mentioned before, are blessed from Shabbat. This is much like the relationship between teacher and student. And this is a beautiful quote, and I actually have it on the handout, but let's read it inside. Where, and this was, I'll tell you who it was. This was Rabbi Chanina. The Talmud says, there was a Rabbi Chanina who said the following. He said, I've learned much from my teachers. I learned even more from my colleagues. But from my students, I've learned the most. So let's get back inside. This is like the relationship between teacher and student, where I've learned much from my teachers, but from my students, I have learned more than from all the others. It doesn't make any sense. If you're the teacher, you have the wisdom. That's why you're the teacher and they're the student. They're the student because they're receiving passively or whatever it is, receiving information. You have the wisdom and you're imparting wisdom to the student. How does it make sense that a teacher should learn from the student? Makes no sense. And yet, Rabbi Chanina said, as much as I've learned from my teachers and as much as I've learned from my colleagues, I've learned the most from my students. That which appears to be lower, that which appears to be the recipient, is in fact, in the final analysis, through a Kabbalistic lens especially, seen to be the highest and the greatest. The greatest ultimate giver is the one who appears to be the recipient. Similarly, he continues, it is written, and remember, this is the previous Rebbe teaching, this at the wedding of who? Who's getting married? His daughter. His daughter is marrying our Rebbe, right? So his daughter, Rebbe Tzion Chaim Mushka, is marrying our Rebbe, right? So he's talking about the value of the bride, the value of the wife. Similarly, it is written, an accomplished woman is the crown of her husband, which means that like a crown which towers over a head, the woman towers over the husband. It is also written, one who has found a wife has found goodness and has brought forth favor from God who is good. And he concludes with a blessing for offspring that are upright and blessed, children and grandchildren who are occupied with Torah and mitzvot. And what he is alluding to at the end is, again, in the giver-receiver relationship, although it seems like the giver would stand above the recipient, right, in rank, ultimately we know that the recipient is from where the blessings truly come, especially when it comes to marriage and that type of relationship. So you have birth, childbirth, that emanates, that is produced, that is created by the mother. So here you have this final message of blessing for offspring, etc. So in conclusion, this discourse is really about understanding the nature of the masculine and the feminine. Hey, see, I'm going overtime. That's what. Okay, listen, hold on one second. Let me just wrap up. Give me 1 minute. Give me 30 seconds. I'll be wrapping up and then we'll get to you. All right, so just in conclusion. So this discourse, and we're gonna study next time the Rebbe's discourse explaining his father-in-law's discourse that he said 25 years later. But just to wrap up the previous Rebbe's discourse, the first discourse, so we have explained masculine, and throughout these several weeks, we've explained the concept of masculine and feminine, relationships, giving and receiving, and ultimately, at the end, the blessing that comes from the recipient. And as is the theme in Judaism, some of the greatest blessings oftentimes come from the most unexpected of places. Thank you very much for joining me today for Kabbalah and coffee. Pleasure.